We've talked about this every time I've come on the show.
Yes.
The Warriors are a great team.
Yes.
So are the Phoenix Suns.
I agree.
So are the Phoenix Suns.
This is levels to it.
But to
this
say their championship window has closed is asinine. No, it hasn't.
It's not asinine.
That was the sound of J.J. Redick, one of the best shooters in organized basketball history, doing something he is already disturbingly good at, taking aim at Stephen A. But there is so much more to J.J.'s post-NBA life as an ESPN analyst that quick sound bites can't quite capture. So today, we get into all of it. Why certain Hall of Famers are angry at him, what really happens in a players-only meeting, and who the main protagonist in the TV show that is the NBA really is. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, December 2nd. This is ESPN Daily. J.J. Redick, it is a pleasure to have you on here. You are, like, I think the first real guest I had when I took over this podcast, and it's taken me a long time to get you back. but you appear as a unique figure in the NBA landscape, man. Like, I don't know what you've pulled off here, but you're a podcast magnate. You're debating Stephen A. Smith and going viral. You're dressed very well today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. You were one of the first pods that I did right after we launched the Old Man and the Three. So I appreciate the love back then.
J.J. Redick played 15 seasons in the NBA, hosts the Old Man and the Three podcast, and is now my coworker at ESPN.
To your point, I'm not entirely sure what's happening right now. I'm just kind of going with the flow. They're asking me to do things. I'm doing them. I've got the podcast going. It was really, truthfully, never my intention to just be out there all the time, but it's ended up that way, I guess.
You've enjoyed this stuff, right? I mean, you clearly have been, as much as it's surprising to find yourself one of us, a talking head, a gas bag, if you will. You like this, man. I can tell.
It's been fun. I hesitate to call myself a talking head, but apparently there are a lot of people out there that now call me that.
That's right.
It's a weird transition to be in, because when I had the podcast as an active player, it was a unique perspective that I was bringing. And obviously, I'm still bringing that through the guests that we're bringing on, who many are still active players. But now on the other side of this, it's weird, Pablo, because I feel like I'm constantly towing the line because I've got to go talk about players. And I think back 6 months ago, 8 months ago, whatever. And I would hate myself, you know? I would hate me, the me that I've become.
I love the me that you've become, JJ. I love that you've become me, I guess is what I'm really saying here. Although, I don't know if I have the cojones, man. Just talk about, I mean, the Stephen A. aspect of this, which is just part of your life, and he's a character that is so big that I am forced to ask you about what it's like to coexist with my colleague, Stephen A. Smith, on TV. But you're remarkably comfortable just going at him. And you've gotten the theater of television down so naturally that I do sense in you, like, you could be a version of yourself that you hate on TV for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, to talk about Stephen A. and that experience so far, I wasn't sure that I would have liked First Take. I don't see myself as a take person. Certainly, I've expressed opinions in the past that have gotten me in trouble.
Yes.
But it's that to me has been the most fun that I've had doing this job so far.
With LeBron, you believe you can take him. You believe he can be had.
To say he's not feared,
not
by
feared.
Players?
Not feared.
I don't know whether to believe that you believe what you're saying.
I do believe
that's
what
you're saying. That's crazy.
Well, it's not crazy.
There's a performative aspect of being essentially on a stage with Stephen A., who's incredibly talented.
I'm not talking about his performance on the court. That's not what I'm saying. And by the
way, LeBron? Who's attacking LeBron?
I'm talking about over the years, people that have come at him.
There's an incredible cadence and delivery to anything he says.
Dude.
You just got to listen to what he says so that you can then go back at him. That's the hard part.
To say that his peers don't fear him, opposing coaches don't fear him.
Listen.
You think people want to go into a playoff series against LeBron?
Yeah, look, I could tell, man, you genuinely relish the theater of this job, the public performance of it. But I also wonder, like, What about being a spectator now that you find yourself enjoying in particular? Because you don't actually have to like compete against these guys anymore.
It's part of the reason last year was so hard, was playing in front of empty arena in empty arenas.
Yes.
It's why watching someone like Steph Curry is such an experience. It's like being at a concert.
Stage presence.
Yes, there's this great clip from the Clippers game. That last step back three he had.
He's going psycho! Psycho Steph is a killer! Don't give Steph a T because the opponent will pay for it.
That has to be one of the most beautifully disrespectful things that has happened on a basketball court, is celebrating by giving the referee who teed you up a tech in return.
The clip is like, you see everyone in the crowd reacting to that shot.
Can't make this dude mad. Look at him talking to the crowd. He's already showed him his championship belt. He's beaten his chest. He's got so much heart.
Some just appalled at the cojones to take that shot. Some people appalled at how good he is. Some people upset because they're Clippers fans. Other people just rooting for greatness. It's that aspect of that fan involvement in a live performance that you just can't. It's really hard to emulate in any other place. There's a larger conversation to be had about what exactly the role and importance of sports are in society. I didn't look at it this way when I was growing up, and I didn't look at it this way early in my career. But as I got older, I looked at the NBA as a form of entertainment. Why do people watch television? Why do people listen to music and go to shows? We want to be entertained. We want to connect to something deeper in our soul that gives us some sense of place and meaning. And sports provides that. And a live performance in sports, when you can witness 20 feet away, Steph Curry bombing 40 footers.
Outside it goes Curry. Three! Another one! 40 points for Curry!
And celebrating with I don't even know how to describe the antics. It's just, it's so performative. It's so entertaining.
Back to Steph for the lead.
I love Steph for so many reasons. Number one, because I'm a fan of the game. Number two, because he gets away with being an in a way that no one else on the planet does. But number three, because I like to imagine JJ, like when you watch him, because look, who you are, guy who ended his NBA career with 1,950 made threes, I believe our crack research team has informed me, 15th all time.
Yeah.
When you watch that guy, who has kind of reshaped and redefined what it means to even shoot a three-pointer. Like, how does that feel to you, like, viscerally, philosophically? Like, what are you watching when you watch Steph Curry?
I said this to SVP a couple weeks ago when I was on a show. To me, this is not hyperbole. To me, Steph has tapped into a higher plane of consciousness than the rest of us. And I thought about when I said that, I thought about it afterwards as I was headed back to the hotel. And there's this great scene at the end of the second Matrix.
Mm.
Neo has just had this epic battle inside the Matrix. He unplugs, they're back on the ship in the underbelly, and they're trying to escape the Sentinels. And the ship runs out of juice or it crashes, I can't remember. And they all get out of the ship and they're running for cover to escape the Sentinels. And Neo says, wait, something's different. I can feel it. And then he magically stops the Sentinels in his tracks. That I can feel it, something's different. As an athlete, we get to experience that 2% of the time, 5% of the time. Maybe that's even being generous. To me, Steph lives in that plane 90% of the time. He's always in the flow.
Gets his own rebound.
I don't remember there being another athlete that I've watched, especially in basketball, that has that.
Steph Curry from downtown. He's got 49 three-pointers. Another 40-point explosion.
So So the feeling that you're describing, and flow state is this thing that psychologists, scientists have tried to measure. It's this state of both calm and also ease. And it lends itself to clearly, in Steph's case, like the most easily repeatable, like neuropsychological mechanics we've seen maybe in sports. Like that feeling, when you have felt it, how do you describe it? Because you're describing a guy who is like macro dosing that feeling. Yeah. But when you micro dose it, what is it like?
Well, yeah, it's a good way to describe it. I was actually going to use the phrase blackout. You're aware of what's going on, but you're not counting what's going on. You're not thinking about the consequences, good or bad, of what's going on. You're just being. And you look back. Maybe it's 5 minutes later, or maybe it's at the end of a game, or maybe it's when you get back to the locker room and your adrenaline and endorphins have kind of eased and you think, man, what just happened? Like, it's almost like an out of body experience. And that to me,
JJ,
that to me is Steph. It's Steph. You know, he goes on this epic run of five straight finals and three championships, multiple MVPs. And then their team sits out the bubble. And he talked about it in an article. And I guess I'd never really thought about how hard that must have been for him.
Mm.
You're talking about someone who has both competitive greatness and competitive stamina. And I can't imagine how that feeling of irrelevancy for him must have been incredibly difficult.
Our vision of what it means to be a you know, the best. Honestly, I know I've heard you talk about this. I mean, for you, it's Kevin Durant. Is that still the case that KD is the number one guy, the number one killer, so to speak, in the league? Or how do you see it?
Yeah, it's a great question. To me, they're the two best players in the world right now. And they're different players, and they get things done in a different way. I just go back to the showmanship. Steph Curry is the greatest show in the basketball world right now.
Yes.
If you had $100 to spend on viewing an NBA basketball game, what team are you buying a ticket to? The Golden State Warriors. It's not even a question.
You know, what's crazy, JJ, is that I would spend that money on the Warriors, whether or not they were playing a contender like the Phoenix Suns, who just wound up hounding Steph into as bad a shooting night as you'll ever see from him on Tuesday. Because I would watch Steph specifically play, I don't know, against the Houston Rockets. I would watch him play in Orlando, in Detroit. It doesn't even matter. And to your point, it really is not close.
We talk about who the basketball world revolves around. Over the last decade, most of the time it's been LeBron. Good portion of that time has been Steph. Some of that time has been James Harden. Some of that time has been Kevin Durant. You go down the list. Jokic, of course, has won MVP. Giannis, with his finals performance last year, back-to-back MVPs. There's all these different guys you can say. Right now, the center of the basketball universe is Steph Curry. That's not to say he's a better player than Kevin Durant, but the center of the basketball universe is Steph Curry.
All right, JJ, after the break, I want to dive further into not just Kevin Durant, but also why you think the conversation around the greatest players in NBA history misses a very important point entirely.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
I'm curious about the KD thing because we've explained what makes Steph unique. But to you, to be better than that guy in the objective basketball sense, how do you explain it to like a layperson? Like when you watch Kevin Durant, what are you seeing there?
Arguably the greatest combination of size and skill in NBA history. Kevin Durant is a hooper. That's his DNA. That's his bloodline. Is like he is a hooper. That's all he thinks about. That's all he wants to do. He just wants to hoop. And you can see the joy he gets from just playing basketball. And there's some other stuff that happens with him and certainly the back and forth. I talked to him last year about this on the podcast.
I just try to keep everything at the game, you know, understand how much people really enjoy watching basketball. And they look at it as entertainment. You know, and once I really start to understand that, I mean, you hear a lot of guys say that, but once I really start to understand how people view us, and especially with me being out this season and just being a spectator and looking at a game from that lens, I'm like, I kind of understand why people so just say anything out their mouth or just so excited to be around basketball or excited that they get to tweet at or get to talk to a basketball player so easily, you know, so I get that excitement. So now it's just like, It's easy to just dust off, you know, because I know people just enjoy the experience overall.
Like, I don't understand why the best player in the world is clapping back at people on Twitter. That seems weird to
me. Yeah, burner accounts, yeah. And then now, yeah. Thankfully, not just out of the closet, yeah. Just straight up burning people himself, yeah.
It's great entertainment, but he wouldn't be as great if he didn't love the game. He's a guy who's put in the work. He's gotten better. He's added to his package constantly. And the fact that he's done this in the last year, coming off an Achilles injury, we don't even talk about this in his 30s.
We never really talk about it.
We never talk about it.
He's 7 feet tall. And it's just like, yeah, I guess he just did that. Yeah. But all of it raises this follow-up question, JJ, because I do want to get your perspective on how we view all of these players in their eras and across eras, because we've discussed on the show before how much of an alien Kevin Durant is, can do all of these things that seven-footers once upon a time could not do and were told actually not to do. So when you saw this recent 75th anniversary team that the NBA itself announced, the top 75 players in NBA history, this was voted by a panel of experts. Like, just be blunt with me here, because, look, I don't want to repeatedly dunk on Bob Cousy, who at 6'1", 175 pounds, was not exactly a prime physical specimen as he was in the 1950s. But I do think it's weird seeing that guy on the same list as Kevin Durant and Giannis and Steph and on and on and on.
Yeah, I got myself into some trouble the last time I talked about this. So I'll try to articulate this in a way that is both logical and provocative. How about that? One thing I would say about the list, I was a little surprised, to be honest with you, that everybody from the top 50 list made it into the top 75 list.
Yes, that's the list the league had previously made about the top 50 players for its 50th anniversary, and all 50 of those guys were included on this list of top 75.
I was surprised at that. When we talk about the greatest players of all time, you have to contextualize that. You have to acknowledge what someone like Bob Cousy did in his era. So I brought up Dolph Schayes on my podcast. You know,
wait, you didn't just bring up Dolph Schayes. Can you please recap for the people who missed this episode of your podcast what you said?
I said that I would like to play. The question was posed to me: Who would you like to play one-on-one in the top 75 list? And I said I would like to play Dolph Schayes, so that I could prove that I'm a top 75 player of all time. My larger point is this. Like Dolph Schayes, he was a sharpshooter. The guy's career field goal percentage was 38%. Bob Cousy never shot over 40% from the field in his career. But look, this is the point. In the context of Bill Russell's era, everybody talks about him being the greatest winner of all time in the NBA. There were many seasons during that 11 out of 13 run when there were eight teams in the league. The argument's been made, oh, well, the league was more concentrated in talent. Bull. the eighth guy on those teams couldn't make Division I basketball now. Okay, I just want to say that. The other part
there's the provocative, yes.
The other part about that era is most people don't even realize this. To win an NBA championship, oftentimes, if you were a high seed, like the Celtics were, you got a bye. You played one series to get to the finals, and then you won another series. So you had to win two series. In today's NBA, you have to win four series. I think it's harder to win an NBA championship now than it was then. But I don't disagree with honoring the past generation of players. In their era, players who dominated their era, in the context of their era, eight teams, whatever, like, let's acknowledge their greatness. Bill Russell is the greatest winner, 100%. But let's contextualize it a little bit. I said, if you took an average player from today's game and put him in the 50s, 60s, he would be a star. And all of a sudden, all these guys from the 90s started coming at me. We're at a place where I think the NBA is, by and large, as talented as it's ever been. You can make an argument, depending on your taste, if you want to watch 84 to 82 basketball. Yeah, I love the 90s, okay? Somebody loves the 90s. If you want to watch a finals game.
I love a hand check,
yeah. If you want to watch a finals game between the Spurs and the Pistons and it ends 77 to 73, by all means, have at it. Have at it. I like watching today's basketball. I think today's basketball is as good as the NBA has ever been. And I think the talent pool is as good as it's ever been.
The top line thing off the top 75 list is that, wait a minute, 11 of the current players are on that list. Four of those 11 are currently on the Los Angeles Lakers. And I know there is this trick we can do where we say, well, that means they have four Hall of Famers, but obviously LeBron James, Russell Westbrook, Anthony Davis, Carmelo Anthony, not all in their peak. What is happening with the Lakers as you see it right now, as they currently struggled, you know, as we project forward to make the play-in tournament potentially?
I always say 2 + 2 does not always equal 4 in the NBA. And the NBA is so much about fit. And I understand, first of all, the Lakers always operate a certain way. We want as many stars as possible. So I understand the trade for Russell Westbrook. I also understand as LeBron gets older, let's ease the playmaking burden a little bit during the regular season and keep him fresh and all that stuff. So I understand why they made the trade. You know, to me, it's not the best fit. You have three guys, essentially, that need the ball in their hands that you can run offense through that aren't great off the ball. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the numbers. Anthony Davis is the least effective jump shooter in the league right now. Russell Westbrook has never been an efficient jump shooter. LeBron is typically at or just below average league three-point shooting. So your three best players are not shooters. So to me, you need shooting. LeBron's quote the other day about this being a huge challenge and them figuring it out, I have no doubt that they're going to be in a position where we could be talking in February, March, April, oh, the Lakers look really good right now. It looks like they figured it out. There's enough talent there. There's enough basketball intelligence there between those three guys and, of course, Melo, that they could figure it out. It's just a matter of how do we fit all these pieces together and create winning basketball.
Yeah, no, the Hollywood sort of approach of the Lakers where you get the big names, you prioritize them. I mean, this came home to roost in a real way on your podcast because you had Alex Caruso on, JJ, and this is not good audio for us because what you had him do was brilliant. You had him blink if this lowball offer was true, basically, and boy, did Alex Caruso blink.
My agent texted me and said, hey, Chicago's interested in signing you. I didn't know that financially it was going to be able to work. So I thought once Zoe signed with Chicago, I was like, okay, well, Chicago's off the list. Like, we're going to look at this, that, and the other and try and make it work. I got on the phone with AK and with Billy, and the way they were just talking about how they wanted to play, you know, how they saw me as a player, I thought they, you know, hit the nail on the head. I thought everything they said, I was like, I think that's accurate. I think that's what I bring to the table. I think that's how I can help the team win. I think that's the, you know, direction that this team wants to go. I thought there was a need for the stuff that I had. So essentially we got that offer, went back to LA, asked if they could do the same, said no. Asked for something else that was a little less, said no. And said, okay, well, if that's what it comes to, I'm ready to go to Chicago and, you know, start the next chapter. And I mean, it's been great. I think it's been a great decision for me.
And I'm just curious, to watch Alex Caruso do what he's doing after being underestimated by Hollywood, and now to be one of the best perimeter on-ball defenders in the league entirely, I like to laugh at how useful he would be on this Lakers team. And any team, basically, at this point.
Yeah. I was a little surprised they let him go. You know, LeBron and the Lakers had enough trust in him to close out a finals game the year they won, to start in that closeout game. He does so many things that maybe don't show up in the box score, but he does so many things that affect winning. We're seeing that with Chicago right now. I would have put a more of a premium on getting him back. And from what he told me, it wasn't like he was asking for an insane contract. He was essentially saying, hey, I got this great offer. Can you give me something close to it? Make it respectable. I want to come back here. I think it's a miss. I think it's a miss. And we're clearly seeing the impact that he's having on winning in Chicago.
All right, JJ, I still need you to take me inside the head of the modern NBA player as they get praised and they get heckled and try to orchestrate these players-only meetings, because I have many questions about all of that after the break.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Well, the kind of like domino effect sliding doors world that we live in, because Alex Caruso is now with the Bulls, and the Bulls are having these moments where they look like a team that is a real playoff like possibility here, more than that. You know, I think about what happened in Boston, right? Because the Boston Celtics blow a 19-point lead to Alex Caruso and the Bulls. And after that game, they hold the thing I want to ask you about, which is a players-only meeting. And I would love, like, the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference to do a study on, like, what happens after players-only meetings. But until that empirical evidence is provided, anecdotally, what is your opinion on the players-only meeting as a concept? What's it like? Have you been in one? Tell me about that.
I've been in a bunch. As a concept, it sounds like a good idea. I've been in good ones and I've been in bad ones. And one of the issues is, if truth isn't expressed, if we don't get to the root of the problem, nothing's accomplished. And so a lot of times, that truth could be a dysfunctional relationship. Hey guys, let's address that. A lot of times that truth could be a star player who's acting like an Hey guys, let's address that. A lot of times it could be a role player who's literally making the same mistake over and over again at crucial times. Hey guys, let's address that. And I think if on the teams that I've been on that have had productive players-only meetings, truth was told, nobody took offense to it, and we got better from it. But if the truth isn't expressed in the meeting, what's the point of having the meeting? It's performative.
A bad players-only meeting, JJ. That sounds like almost unbearably awkward.
That's probably the perfect adjective to describe a bad players only meeting. I think I was sensitive enough to know which guys you had to tell truth to privately and which guys you had to tell truth to publicly. And everybody's different. Everybody psychologically is going to react in a different way. But there were certainly meetings that I was in where I thought to myself 10 minutes in, this is going to go nowhere, and I wish this would stop.
Democracy is hard, JJ. That's what you're describing here.
Yes.
Democracy.
For sure.
Is hard. And policing behavior is hard, which is the next thing I want to ask you about here, because something that happened this week and all year, really, I mean, has been what happens, and this brings us full circle, now ties us together to what we talked about at the top here, but fans being in arenas and players calling out fans for stuff that they have said and or done and or gestured and getting them ejected. We saw this with LeBron in Indianapolis, I believe. We saw this just with Tristan Thompson in Memphis. Allegedly, Memphis Grizzlies fans were yelling about Khloe Kardashian at him. There's a delicate balance, obviously, between being an intense fan and a problematic, like, ejectable fan. And you're somebody who has experienced personally, like, in college at Duke, all of the spectrum of heckles. So how do you see where we are now, and how do you police this stuff?
I would say there was really no consequence to anything that was ever said to me in a college basketball game. It was just a free-for-all. And that was really disappointing, because you would see it. I mean, there'd be a kid screaming things about my sisters that were just absolutely revolting, and there'd be two security guards next to him, and I'm like, what the f-? I think I got two fans kicked out. One was in Atlanta early in my career. I didn't actually get the guy. There was a security guard that I was friends with that I, you know, would always sort of talk to whenever we came through, and somebody said something wildly inappropriate. I was coming back out after halftime. He tossed him. I didn't ask him to be tossed. There was another time when I was playing, I think it was later on in my career, but I was playing in Memphis, and there was these three gentlemen who were sitting front row, and they kept saying that Coach K liked to perform fellatio on me. And the first time they said it, and they obviously said that, and they said it in a very different way than that. They said it once, and I was like, dude, all right, I'm just drunk fan. I'm not even going to worry about it. And then they said it again. And I kind of like looked over, and there was a separate group, a seat away from them on the front row as well. It was like a 11-year-old boy and his parents. I'm like, I don't know if this is the forum to really be saying those things, nor is it really appropriate in general in public to be talking about this. So I gestured to the referee. I said, get that car out of here. And he said, what'd he say? I told him, he said, oh yeah, no, he's gone. And the three guys were just sitting there, and they're like, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. And the guy was like, fine, you're all gone. You're all gone. All three of you are gone. But to answer your question, look, I don't think it's appropriate. You could say, you know, anything about someone's skill or, maybe something funny that has happened in their past. By all means, like, bring it up. It's fine. Like, it's humorous. Be clever. But when you start involving racial undertones, when you start, you know, saying things about somebody's wife or somebody's sister or somebody's mom, or you start talking about crude sexual acts, it's like, dude, not the place for it. Not the place for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it puts content moderation is sort of a key concept that our entire world is grappling with across the internet and also in basketball arenas. And in basketball arenas, especially, JJ, you know, what's interesting to me also is that part of your legend in college was the fact that you took all of this and were awesome despite it. Like, it did seem like from afar, not knowing anything about your internal monologue, that this was something that fueled you, right? That's the cliche that I would have reverted to if you asked me, like, well, what's his relationship to being heckled because he was so good despite it? Has that never been that way for you? Am I totally getting that wrong from afar?
Well, I required 3 years of therapy at Duke for me to deal with it, to be honest with you. I got to Duke, and I'd wanted to go to Duke my whole life. And when I got to Duke, and I sort of became this villain overnight. It wasn't because of anything I'd done. I was just like the guy that everybody was heckling. I embraced it for a while, my freshman and sophomore year. But then it got to the point where I was like, this is not what I signed up for. Like, I don't want to deal with this. Like, people calling my cell phone at 3 a.m., calling me the Antichrist, people heckling my family. Like, it was just not something that I really wanted to deal with. And I've said this before, but you know, I thought about quitting basketball my sophomore year, and my older sisters talked me out of it. And it was less like later on, junior year, senior year, it was less about embracing it and just sort of tuning it out. It became more about being comfortable in my own skin, which is something any 18, 19, 20, 21 year old kid has to figure out. Luckily, I had a great support system to help me do that.
I'm 100% with you on how amazingly helpful it is to have players, coaches, media members, everybody speak about mental health as a concept in a way that just was not talked about like a decade ago. But then there's the part of sports that is sort of like, by design, this pressure cooker that is meant to test you mentally, right? Like, I'm just curious how you square that circle, because part of the job is to be heckled on some level, even if it's, you know, within bounds, so to speak.
I would say there's a basket of things that go into mental health as an athlete, beyond just being heckled. There's the obligation you have to your teammates, your coaches, your family, certainly people pulling at you. There's the performance anxiety that just exists 24 hours a day. People have been asking me, how's retirement? I'm literally as happy as I've ever been. Because I don't walk around with a little sick feeling in my stomach at all times because I've got to go perform. And I would describe that existence just in general as being very tense. But it's part of the game. Like, it's what we signed up for as players. Yes.
Yeah. So let me ask you this as we wrap it up here. When you were a player, I assume you had goals for yourself on the court. Do you have those in the job that you do now?
That's a great question. I break down the reason I loved basketball and loved my career so much into three things. It's the performance aspect, being in front of people, being on stage, results-based, all that stuff. There's a competitive side. There's constant measuring sticks. And then there's the collaborative side. It's working with teammates, working with coaches, working with trainers, all that stuff. You know, all those people involved is what made it so great. And so now it's like the competitive side, the goal-setting side, that's what I'm sort of trying to figure out right now.
JJ Redick, I just want you to know that other people in this business are terrified of you. You're too good at this.
Stop it.
You're too good at this. You are both too logical and too provocative at the same time. So, JJ,
that's got to be the title of this episode.
Absolutely. JJ Redick, my favorite antichrist. Thank you for joining ESPN Daily.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.